intention behind is that parents should carefully think about whether they want to take the risk of giving another vaccine to their child.
A CDC panel votes to stop recommending that all newborns get a hepatitis B shot.
It's Friday, December 5th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead this hour, the aftermath of an immigration surge in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Some parents kept their kids out of school at the height of the operation.
They had notes pinned on their backpack that says, "I am a citizen." I would never think that that's something that I would see.
Plus, Spotify gives users a personalized recap of their year in music, including their so-called listening age.
It creates just another shot to the system for us to talk about. If you're 20 and your listening age is 70, what does that say about you?
Yeah, and should you share it? First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. The man accused of planting two pipe bombs near the U.S. Capitol the night before a mob of Trump supporters stormed the building almost 5 years ago was in federal court today in Washington, D.C. This was Brian Cole Jr.'s first court appearance since his arrest yesterday after a nearly five-year FBI investigation. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports.
At his initial court appearance, Brian Cole Jr. was dressed in a beige jumpsuit and glasses. He stared at the table in front of him as a magistrate judge read the charges, and Cole answered yes when asked if he understood. Prosecutors said Cole spoke with law enforcement for more than 4 hours Thursday following his arrest. They did not provide details in court on what he said, but a person familiar with the matter told NPR that Cole told investigators he believed conspiracy theories that the 2020 election was stolen. Cole is due back in court later this month for a detention hearing. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump has been awarded a peace prize created this year by international soccer governing body FIFA. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports Trump was widely expected to win the award because of his close relationship with the FIFA president.
President Trump accepted the FIFA Peace Prize during the World Cup draw, which sets up the groups and matchups for next summer's tournament being played across North America.
This is truly one of the great honors of my life.
The president often boasts of his role in helping resolve multiple conflicts around the world. The award winner was hardly a surprise, though. Critics cite Trump's close relationship with FIFA president Gianni Infantino, who has been ingratiating himself with the president and is often seen by his side. Infantino has also been a vocal supporter of Trump's effort to win another peace award, the Nobel Peace Prize. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
The Federal Aviation Administration says it has chosen a project manager for its push to overhaul the U.S. air traffic control system. NPR's Joel Rose reports Congress has approved more than $12 billion for the project.
The FAA says it has picked Peraton, a national security company with headquarters in Northern Virginia, as the project manager for its multi-billion dollar effort to overhaul the nation's aging air traffic control system. Congress approved $12.5 billion in July to upgrade the equipment that air traffic controllers use after decades of complaints about technology failures and crumbling facilities. Peraton will act as the single integrator to manage the massive project, according to the FAA, which chose the firm over a joint bid by Parsons and IBM. Aviation industry leaders say $12.5 billion is just a down payment and that it will likely take an additional $20 billion to complete the work. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
Groundbreaking architect Frank Gehry has died. His works were often notable for striking curves. He designed the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain, and Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles. Frank Gehry was 96 years old. This is NPR News. Indiana State House has passed a new congressional map that could net Republicans two seats. The legislation now advances to the state Senate, where it's unclear if enough lawmakers will support its final passage. The effort is part of a national push by President Trump to boost Republicans' chances of keeping control of Congress next year. Hoosier lawmakers had been reluctant to the effort, but they have been under intense pressure from the White House. During a stop in Washington State, U.S. Energy Secretary Chris Wright toured Ice Harbor Dam on the Snake River, the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, and the Hanford Nuclear Cleanup Site. As Northwest Public Broadcasting's Anna King reports, Hanford is where plutonium for bombs was made during World War II and the Cold War.
U.S. Senator Patty Murray has said the Trump administration might not support robust cleanup funding at Hanford, like an expensive new plant that's treating radioactive tank waste. Here's Secretary Wright.
Yeah, of course, there was some crazy story leaked out there, unfortunately, from a local senator here that somehow we were undermining and planning not to do it. Complete nonsense. Was never true.
The secretary said he wasn't aware of stalled progress on another Hanford project, a proposed solar farm that would be the largest in the nation. For NPR News, I'm Anna King.
Michael Jordan testified in a landmark NASCAR antitrust case today. The basketball star is the co-owner of a racing team suing for a more equitable revenue split similar to the NBA. He says NASCAR's business model shortchanges teams and drivers. The U.S. stock market rose to the edge of its all-time high today. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. This is NPR.
It is 5:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Listen to the Season Watch Pod with hosts Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters. Season Watch Pod, for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. New episodes come out on Thursdays, this week being a nature detective and following the tracks in the snow. We receive support from Harmony Food Co-op, Bemidji's full-service downtown grocery store, offering people a variety of local, organic, fair trade, and conventional items. Open daily from 8 to 8. More at harmonyfoods.coop, also on Facebook. The Begley Community Theater presents A Christmas Carol now through December 6th at 7 p.m., plus Sunday, December 7th at 2 p.m. at the Begley High School Auditorium. Tickets available at Ace Hardware in Begley or at the door. Do you rely on KAXE? Are you at least 70 and a half years old? Supporting KAXE's future is easy. Ask your financial advisor to set up charitable IRA distributions to KAXE. Questions? Call Chris at 218-326-1234. The Clearwater County Historical Society in Shevlin hosts the Festival of Trees. Enjoy more than 30 trees and vote for your favorite. Donations of non-perishable food items are encouraged. Special events are each weekend through December 21st. Bovee's Vintage Christmas Celebration is Saturday, December 6th at Bovee City Hall. A craft sale begins at 9, with other activities from noon to 4:30. Enjoy horse-drawn hay rides, reindeer games, crafts, a bonfire, and more.
Steph Levy, a professor of operations management at MIT.
The intention behind this is that parents should carefully think about whether they want to take the risk of giving another vaccine to their child. And many of them might decide that they want to wait far more than 2 months, maybe years, and maybe up to adulthood.
But a CDC official pointed out that this has always been a recommendation and not a vaccine mandate. Still, Levy was one of 8 members who voted for the change. There were 3 members that opposed it. Pediatrician Cody Meissner from Dartmouth said it went against his oath as a doctor to do no harm.
Thoughtful inquiry is always commendable. But that inquiry should not be confused with baseless skepticism.
Many medical professionals also spoke against the vote at the meeting.
Okay, just to emphasize, this was a vote by the advisory committee. It's not binding, so what happens now?
Yeah, so now it's up to the CDC's acting director to decide whether to accept the guidance as policy, and that's a move that could take hours or weeks. We're not sure yet.
Got it. Hey, beyond the committee, beyond the CDC, how are folks you're speaking to responding?
So many in the medical and public health communities are very upset about the vote, and they're worried about its likely impacts on health. Now, that is even though with this change, the hepatitis B vaccine should still be covered for free for any parent who wants it for their child. But Dr. Sue Wong, a physician in New Jersey and a hepatitis B advocate, says it will sow chaos. Fewer babies will be vaccinated.
In years down the road, we are going to see that really nice decline we had with getting acute hepatitis B and chronic hep B cases down. We're going to see it go back up again. And we're going to see rises of liver cancer. And so this is really a travesty.
Those in public health also see it as part of a broader push by Secretary Kennedy to undermine vaccines and discourage people from getting them, even though the evidence in the safety record has not changed. There are signs of that in some of the other topics there.
Other topics. Okay, give me one or two sentences on what other topics were.
Yeah, sure. So the panel heard from Aaron Seary, who's a lawyer who's suing HHS. He questioned the safety of many common childhood vaccines and called for ending vaccine mandates. Mm-hmm. And they also questioned the safety of aluminum-based additives to vaccines that have been used for almost 100 years.
And Pierce Ping Huang. Thank you, Ping.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration's aggressive immigration crackdown has arrived in New Orleans and Minneapolis as federal agents continue expanding their dragnet for undocumented immigrants. This follows a recent strike in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hundreds of Border Patrol officers descended on the city November 15th, arresting about 400 people in a week-long operation. The enforcement surge there appears to be over, but as NPR's Adrian Florido reports, Charlotte is still grappling with the fallout.
It's the end of the school day, and a yellow school bus pulls up outside an apartment complex in East Charlotte that is home mostly to immigrants. About 10 elementary school-aged children hop out. There are no parents to greet them, as there normally would be. The kids walk and run the rest of the way home alone. It's just one way that life looks different in Charlotte in the aftermath of the Border Patrol's operation here last month.
It's like a hurricane came through.
Stephanie Sneed is chair of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Board of Education.
We're still not quite sure if the storms are completely over. And then we have to deal with the aftermath, which is much longer than the event itself.
At the height of the operation last month, about 20% of the district's 141,000 students stayed home. Parents have started sending them back, but with precautions, Sneed says.
They had notes pinned on their backpack that says, "I am a citizen." I would never think that that's something that I would see.
The economic impact is also still visible everywhere. It's visible in the shuttered Mexican food truck owned by a woman who asked that we ID her by her first initial, E, because she's undocumented. E and her family were preparing meals in the food truck when, on November 14th, they saw on social media that a large Border Patrol convoy was driving toward Charlotte. They panicked.
Cuando nosotros vimos eso, en ese momento agarramos, cerramos la traila y dijimos no más.
We closed the truck and we said no more, E says. They rushed home and locked themselves in. The next morning, she watched on TV as federal agents started nabbing people off the streets and raiding construction sites. 3 weeks later, E still will not step outside her house. She doesn't believe the Border Patrol agents who swarmed the city are actually gone.
Pues ellos están esperando el momento que nosotros salgamos para que ellos nos casen como los gatos, el gato y el ratón.
They're waiting for us to go outside again, she says, so they can hunt us like a cat hunts a mouse. Charlotte has been one of the nation's fastest growing cities for more than two decades, in part because it became a banking center. Tom Hanchett is a Charlotte historian.
In the 90s, Bank of America built the tallest building on our skyline, and the story is they hired a steel-setting crew from Texas. And there were a lot of Hispanic people and a lot of Mexican natives standing up there on that steel looking down going, well, it's a pretty nice place. It's got a booming economy, and maybe we could, you know, try to make it here.
And they did make it here. Today, about a fifth of Charlotte's population is foreign-born. Many Latino immigrants here work in construction, hospitality, and own small businesses. Manolo Betancur is one small business owner. He's from Colombia. He's owned a popular Latino bakery here for 28 years. I meet him on the now empty sidewalks of Central Avenue, usually bustling with foot traffic.
This avenue is always packed. All the time. You know, go to the laundry, go to the grocery stores, come to the restaurants.
On the morning the Border Patrol arrived, he was walking to his bakery with his U.S. passport in his pocket when an SUV stopped half a block ahead of him. What he saw is seared in his mind. Agents jumped out, tackled three men who looked Latino, zip-tied their wrists, and hauled them away.
And I just turned around and I saw a lot of people that were coming this way.
Like walking this way, families.
Yeah, walking this way, families. So I just turned around and I told them, they're here, and just go back to your house, and everybody started running.
He called his employees and told them to lock the bakery doors. Later that day, he announced online that he was closing Manolo's bakery.
I don't want for people to tell their kids, I'm going to go to the bakery to get your birthday cake, and then that kid never going to get her father back or her mother back.
Casey Crimmins runs Project 658, which provides services to immigrants in Charlotte, including medical care. When he saw Manolo Betancourt on the news saying he was closing shop, his heart dropped.
When it's in Chicago, when it's in LA, there's scrollable shorts. When it's Manolo, who I literally had just seen 4 days before, saying to a camera, I've never seen anything like this before. I have to shut down my shop. It just hits different.
He and others in the community sprung into action, alerting people about raids, helping kids get to school, delivering food to immigrants' homes. Crimmins says residents want to show that this is still a welcoming city, a reputation forged on hard-earned trust.
This brought a sense that all of that that was built up over decades got flushed down the toilet.
Diabetes,
yeah.
Two employees of a medical clinic his group oversees, Lindsay Velker and Mary Beth Stanford Picker, are out delivering medicine and food to an undocumented patient.
Estamos aquí afuera de su casa con sus medicamentos y la comida también.
The patient is an older woman from Honduras. Okay. She requested that we use only her first initial, R. The week Border Patrol was in town, she says, agents roaming her apartment complex knocked on her door two different times.
Como hay un hoyito, ahí se ve. Entonces yo vi que habían dos.
She recognized their beige uniforms through the peephole. She stayed quiet and they left, but she is still struggling to sleep. R cares for children while their parents are at work. Her income plummeted when people stopped bringing their kids. Today, she's only caring for two kids. She walks them to school, but she stopped using the sidewalk and started walking through the woods.
Un caminito, yo misma abrí con un machete el caminito, unas ramas que habían ahí.
She cut a path through the brush with a machete. They won't find me in there, she says, with a nervous laughter. Daniela Andrade is with the Carolina Migrant Network, an advocacy group. She says Charlotte won't be back to normal until people feel safe again.
Because it's very hard to say, oh, they're gone and let's live, go back to normal life. It's really hard to, right now in these moments of crisis and fear in our community, to tell folks to trust.
Instead, she and other advocates have been telling people not to let their guards down. Adrian Florido, NPR News, Charlotte, North Carolina.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 5:18. We've got more news coming up from All Things Considered at 5:30. We'll bring you the latest Up North report. Also bring you a segment from Megan Buffington coming up next. I'm Heidi Holton. We would like to thank our business supporters, and that includes Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.com. And thanks to Woodworks Homes, dedicated to the art of building in northern Minnesota by constructing handcrafted new homes and offering remodeling services. More at woodworksmn.com. Megan Buffington's one of the reporters from the KEXE newsroom.
Essentia Health Boston is hosting its 21st annual Tree Walk for Hospice on Sunday. Attendees can stroll through decorated Christmas trees created by local organizations and community members and bid on their favorite tree through a silent auction. Crystal angel ornaments will also be available for purchase in honor or memory of a loved one. Funds raised from the event will support specialized care for patients and families served through hospice. The Fosden Langby Lions Club will serve a free will donation breakfast from 10 a.m. to noon, and a remembrance program with a candle lighting ceremony starts at 12:15. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington.
More news is coming up from our newsroom. That's coming up at 5:30. Tonight at 6, it's the Night We Light Parade in downtown Bemidji. Downtown Walker invites you to the Festival of Lights, and that's the tree lighting at 6 with the parade at 5. beginning, oh, it's going on right now. And the Heartland Lakes Community Tree Lighting in downtown Park Rapids begins at 6 o'clock. More is coming up next from National Public Radio. Thanks so much for supporting People Powered KAXE.
For NPR, comes from this station. And from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from Subaru, the Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Sudan has been at the center of a brutal war since April of 2023. It's the site of the world's largest hunger crisis. More than 4 million people have fled the country since war broke out, and the World Health Organization estimates at least 40,000 people have been killed. Rund Abdel Fattah and Ramtin Arablouei, co-hosts of NPR's history show Throughline, tell us the story of how things got so bad.
The roots of today's war in Sudan go back over a century, from British colonial rule to a cycle of revolutions and coups that started after Sudan gained independence in the 1950s. In 1989, that cycle turned once more. A man named Omar al-Bashir took control of Sudan in a coup, and as soon as he had power, he turned his attention to trying to keep it.
For decades, he ruled with an iron fist. The average Sudanese person suffered. The economy was poor, and people struggled to find food to eat.
The protests against Bashir started, unsurprisingly, in the periphery.
This is Khulod Khair. She's a Sudanese political analyst who runs a think tank called Confluence Advisory.
December 2018, a bunch of schoolchildren who were protesting that their sandwiches at school were too expensive.
The government's response was swift and harsh.
The government has been using live ammunition and tear gas to disperse the crowds.
And very quickly, that caught the hearts and minds of many, many people.
The protests spread throughout the country. A mood of possibility was in the air.
Demonstrators who've been met with live bullets and tear gas say they want President Omar al-Bashir's nearly 30-year reign to end.
At the beginning, things were very rosy.
This is Ibrahim El-Badawi. He's a Sudanese economist.
And the army switched loyalty to the public, declared that it's actually going to support the revolution.
Hemeti and General Burhan, as the kind of two most powerful military figures in the country, worked together to kick Bashir out.
This is Christopher Townsell. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Washington, who focuses on the history of modern Sudan. Burhan was a top general in Bashir's armed forces. Hemeti commanded the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. And Christopher says that after Bashir fell, it seemed like both generals would do as they'd promised and cede their power to a new civilian government.
I arrived just one day earlier, before the massacre.
2 months after the triumphant moment of Bashir's fall, Ibrahim al-Badawi came to Khartoum. He was there to support protesters who were staging a sit-in outside the army's headquarters because the generals had not ceded power. They met the protesters with force.
We're being attacked by the Rapid Police Forces and the police.
There was a sense of despair, actually. And the whole country was just devastated.
The Khartoum massacre in June 2019. Hemeti's Rapid Support Forces opened fire on civilian protesters, killing more than 100. Many more were beaten, raped, and violently detained. And the military, led by Burhan, watched it all happen, right on its doorstep. This was the same military and the same RSF that had seemed so eager to support this democratic revolution a couple of months earlier, to help the starving and impoverished and turn Bashir's 30-year rule over to the people. But now, Burhan and Hemeti had turned on the people.
But then, shortly after, this triggered a massive outpouring of protest all over the country. And so eventually they were forced to negotiate with the leadership of the revolution.
Ethiopia and the African Union stepped in to help Sudan set up a transitional government that would eventually hand off to a civilian elected administration, finally bringing true democracy to Sudan. Both civilians and military officials were chosen to serve on the Transition Council. Burhan and Hemeti each had a seat at the table. It helped that the U.S. and other Western powers lifted sanctions on the country.
Opportunities were open to Sudan, big time. Debt relief, political openness, and so on.
At first, that seemed to work for Burhan and Hemeti.
But I do think, though, that they were reluctant partners.
Reluctant partners who, in hindsight, he says, had never actually committed to the idea that the military would hand power back to civilians.
Some Sudanese, they call it a creeping coup.
In 2021, with the country moving closer to the day when the military was supposed to hand control of the government off to civilians, Hemeti and Burhan decided their time had come.
Sudan was moving toward democracy, but then today the military arrested the transitional government's leaders and put the acting prime minister under house arrest.
Burhan took over control of the country, and both generals were amassing wealth and power. But even as they appeared to be working together, the two men were on a collision course, because there was one big thing they couldn't agree on.
And this was the future role of the Rapid Support Forces.
The paramilitary force Hemeti still controlled.
Whether the Rapid Support Forces would be incorporated sooner or later into the army. Burhan wanted it to be incorporated sooner, 2 years. Hemeti wanted it to be 10 years. It would obviously kind of protect him longer.
Neither Burhan nor Hemeti was willing to budge.
And that would put the country on a path to this tragic war.
What happens in April 2023 is the beginning of the trauma and the hellscape.
And then once the fighting broke out, it could never be stopped.
There's one more layer to this conflict, and it's the most tragic one. Khulod Kher says both generals, Burhan and Hemeti, actually share a common enemy in this war, the people of Sudan, and the dream of democracy many have held for decades.
It is a war against civilians. And so while they are fighting each other, they're also fighting the civilians of Sudan, who they recognize as the true change agents in the country. And what's interesting about Sudan's history, that has such a long history of armed conflict, there's always been non-violent action by a large proportion of different groups of Sudanese people that have brought down military dictatorships.
That was Sudanese political analyst Khulod Kher, Sudanese economist Ibrahim El-Badawi, and University of Washington professor Christopher Townsell. You can hear the full episode on the war in Sudan and more from Throughline hosts Ramtin Arablouei and Rund Abdel Fattah wherever you get your podcasts.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KPXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Smiles for Jake hosts Snow Many Smiles at Crosby Memorial Park, Saturday, December 6th from 3 to 6. This free family event will be in heated tents with a petting zoo, cookie decorating, letters to Santa, and more, ending with fireworks at 6 o'clock. Now it's time for the Up North Report here on KAXE KBXE.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with a special edition of the Up North Report.
As artificial intelligence becomes more ubiquitous with modern-day life, the demand for data centers is growing, and developers are increasingly looking away from urban places to build them. Rural America offers plenty of space to develop renewable energy sources in sprawling campuses, and rural communities usually have more relaxed regulatory processes for construction compared to dense urban centers. In the land of 10,000 lakes, data center developers may be attracted to tax breaks offered by the Minnesota legislature in 2025, in addition to the state's cold climate. While about 80 data centers are concentrated around the Twin Cities, more are being built in suburban and rural areas. Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, is slated to open a data center in Rosemount in 2026. 12 more hyperscale data centers are in various phases of exploration in the state, including a Hermantown project that has been on hold since mid-November. These projects bring promises of construction jobs, technician jobs, and a boost to local property tax revenue, but some environmental and grassroots groups are concerned about how data centers can negatively impact rural communities.
There's a lot of capacity, technical capacity and expertise that comes with being in the metro area that rural Minnesota and rural municipalities and communities just don't have. There's not a consistency of access to engineers and hydrologists, and all of that's entailed to manage these complex projects.
That was Peg Fershong from CURE, a rural environmental advocacy group that focuses on issues in greater Minnesota, during the November meeting of the Environmental Quality Board. During this meeting, the EQB hosted its second informational session on data centers with a focus on water resources. Data centers are essentially warehouses that host servers that power the internet, from mobile phone applications to sensitive government data systems. The servers are seldom powered off due to the 24/7, 365 demands of internet users, requiring more systems to cool them down. That's where data centers can call for large volumes of water. In the data center regulations cleared by the legislature at the end of last session, the State Department of Natural Resources can inquire about water resources as developers plan out data centers. From the DNR, Assistant Ecological and Water Resources Director Jason Meckel explains to EQB board members.
What's the geology? Therefore, what do we know about the availability of water? What are the existing users in the area? What kind of natural resources are associated with those aquifers? And given an understanding of what's proposed for how the water will be used, when it will be used, how it will be pumped, what might the constraints be at that given site?
The DNR issues water appropriations permits when projects are expected to use at least 100 million gallons per year. While Minnesota is a very wet state, there are frequent periods of drought, and aquifers can draw down in the summer with agriculture's irrigation demands. Steve Robertson from the Minnesota Department of Health says cities with municipal water systems have much to consider when approving data center developments.
There's the general issue of maintaining the public trust. So with a public water system, that's a key consideration. It's largely because new large developments of all kinds, including those involving new large volume water users, really bear on maintaining or stewarding the public trust relative to delivering a product like drinking water that many people prioritize for their own public health protection.
If the data center plans include establishing a new water supply, that can affect private well owners as well, Robertson says.
It would not be unusual for a new large volume water user to satisfy its needs by developing a new source of supply. In Minnesota, that's most commonly going to be with a new well. And the principal issue that this presents to the local community is that a new well has the potential to alter the groundwater flow regime in a significant way.
If a new large well is established, nearby smaller wells with shorter straws may have difficulty accessing the water from the same aquifer. Information from these data center sessions in October and November is slated to help guide further work for the Environmental Quality Board focused on its two priorities, supporting program development on emerging environmental issues and to improve the state's environmental review program. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from EBSCO, supporting open source technology and making open platforms possible for libraries of all sizes. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From Arm, on the latest episode of Tech Unheard, Arm CEO and host Rene Haas talks to Jayshree Ullal, CEO of cloud networking company Arista Networks, about how tech and AI are helping to shape the future of computing. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. In a blockbuster Hollywood deal announced this morning, Netflix said it's buying the vast studios and streaming properties of Warner Brothers Discovery. CNN and other cable channels owned by Warner Brothers are not part of the deal, but this would create a global entertainment and streaming giant. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is here with more. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, David, Netflix is already the world's leading streamer, so why does it want or really need to buy Warner Brothers?
Yeah, and let's underscore the fact this is a departure for Netflix, which has not been in the business of acquiring. It's been in the business of building or licensing content for itself. I think it's a signal Netflix wants to be the everything store, the Amazon of entertainment, right? That they are going to, they're already the world's leading streamer. They're already a dominant name in American streaming, and that they want to essentially blot out the landscape as others are trying to grapple with them. So they're putting together the Warner Brothers movie studio plus HBO, you know, one of the great brands, and HBO Max, whatever name it's going by on any given day, put that together with Netflix. They've promised to continue to release Warner Brothers movies theatrically in theaters, but it would give it huge control over entertainment content. Some of the iconic hits coming under the same umbrella, Game of Thrones franchise, Harry Potter from Warner Brothers, and Squid Game. You know, these are elements of huge things that keep people coming back again and again.
I mean, Discovery and Warner Brothers are some of the biggest names in the industry. How could this change the shape of Hollywood?
Well, it's allowing Netflix to have access to, you know, all the intellectual property of Warner Brothers as well as their future things, assuming this deal goes through. You know, if you think of other franchises, there's Looney Tunes, one of the totems of my youth, but also the DC superhero franchises, right? And Warner Brothers has, in some ways, surprisingly, had a lot of successful movies lately, but Hollywood has been sculpting itself around the challenge that Netflix has posed. So you saw Disney not too many years ago acquire most of Fox's entertainment holdings to bulk up and supersize. You've seen Comcast and Paramount thinking that they would have a strong chance. In Paramount's case, they thought they had the inside track to acquire Warner Brothers studios and streaming services so that they could elevate from being CBS and NBC and Paramount and Universal, respectively, combine it with Warner Brothers and take on Netflix. Netflix is saying, no, we're going to supersize the supersizing. This is a behemoth, a colossus bestriding the world of entertainment should it comes to pass.
I mean, anytime two companies that are in the same businesses merge, there's a big if. There are these antitrust concerns. How hard do you think it'll be for Netflix to actually get this approved?
Well, so let's talk about this in two ways, one of which is the conventional notion of antitrust, and that is the amalgamation or the combining of too many things that are of a like kind in ways that can distort the market for other players in the market, distort the market for consumers. After all, people are already shelling out, you know, in the teens of dollars each month for Netflix and for those who also subscribe to HBO, HBO Max for that. What leverage would this provide Netflix to raise that cost? I think you're going to see the antitrust division of the U.S. Department of Justice, which is led by somebody who takes a keen interest in these matters, really give a hard look at, does this concentrate too much power in the industry in this way? And you're seeing state attorneys general have questions about that and become more, shall we say, aerobic and muscular in thinking about antitrust issues of late. And you're also likely to see that, to be honest, in Europe, in the European Union. Let's talk about Trump world. President Trump plays an outside role in all of this, even though conventionally presidents aren't supposed to weigh in on these kinds of decisions. Donald Trump made clear that he thought that the path should be eased for the Ellison family, that his father and son, Larry Ellison, co-founder of Oracle, one of the richest humans on the planet, one of a handful of the richest people on Earth, and David Ellison, his son, the head of Skydance, who engineered just this year the takeover of CBS's parent company and Paramount's parent company, now called Paramount Global, merged that with Skydance. He was thinking, we're going to take all of Warner Brothers Discovery, all of their studios, all of their content, all of their cable properties, pump up Paramount, we're going to take on this. they're going to try to challenge this in a variety of ways, they've signaled. And we're going to see how that goes. The question of what Trump wants matters these days. His Justice Department clearly takes its cues. So I think that's going to be a real second strain to that question.
And David, the one thing we haven't really touched on is those cable properties you mentioned. What happens to CNN and the other cable properties if this deal does go through?
So as Comcast did with its cable properties, these would be spun off, presumably so someone could purchase it. The people who you'd think might be most interested might be the Ellisons. After all, they just acquired CBS and have been thinking about CBS News, might want to fold CNN in. But it is making these places vulnerable. It's not clear what their future holds.
NPR Media Correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you.
You bet.
Spotify Wrapped is here, offering users a personalized recap of their year in music. This time around, the streaming platform is also calculating their so-called listening age. As NPR's Rachel Treisman reports, it's not necessarily what you would expect.
This week, I found out I'm 70 years old. At least that's my listening age, according to Spotify. That's because I listen to a lot of 70s music, like Billy Joel's The Stranger, 21 times. Then I felt the stranger kick me right between the eyes. For the last decade, Spotify has ended every year with an interactive recap of each user's listening habits. It usually includes their top songs, artists, albums, genres, and listening time.
Spotify Wrapped is by and large an identity project for its consumers.
That's Marcus Collins, a professor at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business, and an R&B fan with a listening age of 40 and a love of Boys to Men. It's become the norm for listeners to share their Spotify stats on social media.
It's a way by which we're able to project our identity based upon our cultural consumption.
Your listening age offers another way to do that, especially if it's multiple decades off your actual age.
It creates just another shock to the system for us to talk about. If you're 20 and your listening age is 70, what's that say about you?
Spotify is relying on a concept called the reminiscence bump, which says adults feel most connected to music from their teen years. So it looks at which five-year window of music you listen to more than your peers and does the math as if you were a teenager during that era.
For instance, for me, I still always return back to 90s R&B and 90s hip hop. It jettisons us back to a time when we were sort of figuring ourselves out.
Those calculations can yield some pretty dramatic results if the social media memes are any indication. Songwriter Gracie Abrams' listening age is 14, about half her actual age, while electropop artist Charlie XCX clocks in at 75. Colin says this kind of shock value works to Spotify's advantage.
Because we don't talk about the things that are just boring. We talk about the things that are unbelievable.
So is Spotify rage baiting us for free publicity, or is it giving us a helpful way to connect?
The truth of the matter, it's both of them at the same time.
Collins, like many of us, learned about Spotify Wrapped's release from social media, not paid advertisements.
Then I said, oh, I want to know what mine is so that I can engage in the discourse, not because I love Spotify so much, but because I want to participate in the social practices of my people.
And that's a tale as old as time. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The Ganges River in India is a sacred place in Hindu traditions. People put their loved ones' ashes in its waters as a final rite. But what happens when a family can't make the trip to India? Rose Schnabel with WUFT tells the story from Florida.
Growing up in South Africa as an Indian woman during apartheid wasn't easy for Vasanthi Doshi. She was born in 1942. She found comfort in music and sang from a Boy Scout songbook. She especially loved a song about the Swanee River by Stephen Foster.
Way down upon the Swanee River.
This Bing Crosby rendition came out in her childhood.
Somehow we just all wanted that song first. Very sad song. But with the sadness comes this hope that things would be better.
Today, the original 1851 lyrics are viewed as racist, They depict an enslaved person nostalgic for their days on a plantation. But to Vasanthi, now 83, the song meant something else, the chance to be far away from apartheid's reach. She got that chance after she married in 1970 and eventually moved to Florida after visiting college friends there. One day, her husband, Paresh, entered an auction for a rundown motel in Old Town, Florida, and won. The rooms backed up to a river.
It was not very visible at that time, you know, because of the overgrown foliage and the trees and all that. But I stepped out to the dock. There were steps going down to see how it was laid out. And I said, wow, what a spot.
He kept the river a secret from his wife, Vasanthi, who was angry at his real estate purchase.
I told him, you cannot buy that property. And he said, you just have to come one time tomorrow.
So she did. And it was Paresh who led her to the river.
So he's in the front pulling me, and I didn't want to go. Went on. It took a while till I got to the end.
But then she saw it, the Suwannee River.
What God does for us, we have no idea.
A few years later, when Vasanthi's dad passed away, she invited a dozen Indian families over for a funeral ceremony on the river.
They were shocked that I was doing that. And then started calling me.
Their motel has now become a gathering place for families who can't travel to the Ganges for funerals. Vasudha Narayanan directs the study of Hindu traditions at the University of Florida. She says Hindus believe sprinkling a loved one's ashes in the Ganges liberates the soul from the body, and local rivers often become a substitute.
They know it's the Suwannee or the Mississippi. They do think it is infused with the sacrality of the mother of all rivers, which is the river Ganga from India.
Vasanthi has started calling the Suwannee River her Ganga. People come from over 100 miles for the funeral ceremony. Her daughter Sapna gives a demonstration.
So what we're doing right now is lighting the lamp to put the boat in the water in memory of anyone who's passed.
The paper boat carries flower petals to make the soul's journey sweeter. Sometimes families scatter ashes in the water too, which Florida law doesn't regulate. But today, Sapna just watches the boat drift away in the heart of rural Dixie County, down here upon the Suwannee River. For NPR News, I'm Rose Schnabel in Old Town, Florida.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's Apple Service Center in Bemidji and Grand Rapids, offering both in-warranty and out-of-warranty service on Apple products and computer repair. More at paulbunyan.net. United Way of Bemidji area has a VIP and me dance tomorrow from 4 to 7 at The Loft in Bemidji. Kids and their caregivers can enjoy ornament making, games, and snacks in addition to dancing. Proceeds benefit the Radiothon to end child abuse. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewing.co. Deer River has a holiday kickoff celebration tomorrow with crafts and cookie decorating at King Elementary from 10 to 3, then a tree lighting ceremony and caroling at 4:45 by the fish statue, followed by hay rides, leaving from the Deer River Vets Club from 5 to 7. You can cut your own Christmas tree in the Superior or Chippewa National Forests. Permits are now available at recreation.gov. You may also stop by a district office to get a permit. Concordia Language Villages near Bemidji has their International Holiday Market now through December 7th and December 11th through the 14th from 10 to 6 each day. Shop ornaments, apparel, food, and more from 14 different cultures. The Brainerd Noon Sartoma Club presents Winter Wonderland, a drive-through light display at Northland Arboretum in Brainerd. It runs Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays from 5:30 to 8, plus the full week between Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve. Advance tickets available at BrainerdNoonSartoma.org. Now back to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. It has been a banner year for Indiana sports teams. All of the state's major league professional teams, as well as a few universities, have racked up impressive winning records. For fans, it is a thrilling time after some truly lackluster seasons. Team owners, coaches, and players say this year's success follows years of investment and development. Samantha Horton with member station WFYI reports.
For sports fans in Indiana, the excitement started early in the year when Notre Dame's Fighting Irish made it to the College Football National Championship. And in the spring, the Indiana Pacers were in the NBA Finals. In the fall, the Indiana Fever made it to the WNBA playoffs. Before each playoff game for the Pacers and Fever, volunteers set rally towels and t-shirts on thousands of arena seats. Fever General Manager Amber Cox says the enthusiasm of all those fans motivated the players.
You want to play for them. You want to continue to show up for them. So, you know, through the tough times, they've been there for us and have been really our fuel throughout this season.
The good news continued in October. The Associated Press ranked Purdue University men's basketball number one in its annual preseason poll. And now Indiana University football and the Indianapolis Colts are having winning seasons. That's energized fans like Tom Henshaw. Before a recent Colts game, he was grilling food and tailgating with friends and family at a new spot a few blocks from the stadium. Henshaw jokes it may be superstitious, but the group can't go back to their old spot because they don't want to make a change while the Colts are on a roll.
Yeah, you can see that it's come together finally this year. We don't normally get to see home wins.
And athletes are getting into the excitement too. Fever point guard Sydney Colson says she has a Colts jersey now. And at basketball games, athletes are showing up for each other.
It's cool to see like the sections where it's several players coming to support the Pacers or the Fever. And that's cool to see from a city that all the teams support one another.
Amy Matheny says for Indiana University, it's taken years of strategic building to assemble the winning Hoosiers football team.
Lots of discussions. Oh my gosh. You know, it isn't like we haven't wanted to be good in football. We have, but doing it and competing for it, you know, is very different.
Matheny is a lifelong Hoosier who's in the Indiana Basketball Hall of Fame. She says raising coaches' salaries and taking advantage of opportunities that can be offered to recruits have helped. And it's not just about Indiana teams. Indianapolis, a city that bills itself as a sports capital, has recently hosted several major sporting events, including the NBA and WNBA All-Star Games and the U.S. Olympic trials for swimming and diving. The state is also home to the NCAA, three national governing bodies, and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Indiana Sports Corp President Patrick Talty says the goal is to make the state an international sports destination.
We unveiled last year our 2050 vision, which is the next the strategy for the next 25 years of the sports strategy. And we really believe that Indiana can be the global epicenter of sport.
And that's something Indiana sports fans say they already know. For NPR News, I'm Samantha Horton in Indianapolis.
Philadelphia is known as the city of brotherly love. But that love can be tested when it comes to sports rivalries, also when it comes to the ingredients that make a cheesesteak great. Recently, the Michelin Guide honored three cheesesteak joints in the city. Food critics pounced on the judges, but reporter Buffy Gorilla found nothing but love for the vibrant cheesesteak scene.
The following customers are ready for pickup.
The smell of meat and onions hangs in the air outside D'Alessandro's in Roxborough. It's a few minutes after 11 a.m., and D'Alessandro's just opened its windows for the day.
The best cheesesteaks in the city.
A bundled up Dante Cunningham waits for his order.
The regular cheesesteak, mayonnaise, fried onions, ketchup, pickles, and mustard, standard.
At D'Alessandro's, the go-to cheese is sharp American. The meat, fresh sliced ribeye. But Cunningham says it's not about the meat.
The bread is key. If anybody know anything about cheesesteaks in Philly, it's about the bread. It's not about the steak and everything. It's about the bread.
D'Alessandro's is one of three Philadelphia cheesesteak places that Michelin awarded a Bib Gourmand. If you haven't heard of the Bib Gourmand, you are not alone.
What's that?
I've not heard of it, but I think without a doubt they're worthy of that award.
Well, Jack McGonigal and Jake Carvalho, the Michelin Guide's Bib Gourmand highlights places that serve quality food at reasonable prices. New Jersey native Carvalho loves a cheesesteak. After driving 10 hours from North Carolina he made a detour to get one laden with onions and peppers from his favorite spot, D'Alessandro's.
It's about my fourth time here, and I'm in love with it, man. Every time I come by Philly, I gotta make a stop here.
Angelo's in South Philly also made Michelin's list.
My dad used to swear by Angelo's, as a matter of fact, until he came here. Yeah. I made him come here one time. He was like, wow, this is actually a lot better. Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. Angelo's still, it's great. It's great. No hate to Angelo's. It's a great spot. But hey, everybody's got their own opinion, though, you know?
Del Rossi's in the Northern Liberties neighborhood received a Bib Gourmand, too. They make their seeded sourdough bread in-house, and the place smells amazing. Since I was going to be there, my neighbor asked me to grab her a cheesesteak. Kathy Cote grew up in the Philadelphia suburbs and has lived in the city for over 40 years. Cote proudly claims to be a bit of a cheesesteak aficionado and thinks the Michelin accolades for this food are overdue.
It's about time. I mean, if they're going to do a food overview in Philadelphia, you need to include cheesesteaks. I mean, this is our unique specialty.
Cote unwraps her still steaming sandwich.
I've never had any cheesesteak from Del Rossi. I thought I should try the real thing. It is extremely heavy.
After her first bite, she reaches for a napkin.
It's a mess. Oh, it's good. It's really good. The roll's really good. It's huge.
When deciding where to get your cheesesteak, there are some big questions to consider. Chopping the meat versus slicing, soft bread versus a more structured option. But as Nish Patel, owner of Del Rossi, sees it.
Everyone has their favorite and people battle it out in the comments all the time, which is great to see.
When it comes to cheesesteaks, some places even dare to ditch the meat for the vegetarians and vegans out there. So there really is something for everyone. For NPR News, I'm Buffy Gorilla in Philadelphia.
Breast cancer among men is rare, but it is real. Some studies suggest it's more common among veterans, and the Department of Veterans Affairs says it diagnoses about 100 cases a year. So why did the VA make it harder for affected male veterans to get care and benefits? We'll have reporting on Monday's show. If you're not by the radio, try asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your station by name.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features presenting Hamnet, a story of love and loss that inspired the creation of Shakespeare's Hamlet, directed by Chloe Zhao, now playing in theaters everywhere. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals whose ideas, solutions, and discoveries expand people's expectations of what's possible. macfound.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. Support for KAXE comes from Itasca Orchestra and Strings Program's Family Christmas on Saturday, December 20th at 4 p.m. at the Rife in Grand Rapids, bringing the snowman to life with a film projection and live orchestra music to accompany. Tickets and info available at itascaorchestra.org/events. Weather tonight, 4 below to 1 above for lows. Northwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Gusts getting up to 20. Mostly cloudy, becoming mostly clear.